UCCF's BeThinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on BeThinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
Dearest Father, we thank you that we have a chance to engage these issues. I pray that you would be with us, Lord. Nothing that we do, no cleverness, no creativity, nothing will avail unless you inhabit the work of your people. So we would echo the prayer of Moses, establish the work of our hands for the glory of your name and for the name of your Son, in whose name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
All right. Now, I'm supposed to be like a servant to you guys, but the problem is, let me introduce myself. My name's Ted Turnow, and I've been interested in the relationship between popular culture and apologetics for maybe 10, 15, I don't know, long time. And I did my doctoral dissertation on that. And what was the title of the doctoral dissertation? It was actually on Recur. It was Paul Recur, Reimagining Recur, Popular Culture as Text, Metaphor, and Narrative. But it's not going to get that technical here. So I'm supposed to be a servant to you guys. I'm supposed to be a real servant. Problem is, I don't feel like a servant. I feel like a little kid who is bringing a select group of his friends to his secret swimming hole. It looks like the select group of friends turned into a parade, but that's okay. And so I'm really anxious that we get to dive right in. That can be a good thing, and it could be a bad thing. Can I see all of the hands of the non-native English speakers in here? Okay. For you, this can... Yeah, the Scotsman raises his hand. For you, this can be a bad thing, because I will go gallopy, 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 and you guys are going to say, what is this babbler talking about? So I am pleading with you guys, you people who raised your hands, you non-native English speakers, please, 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 if I'm going too fast, if I'm throwing words at you, you don't know. There is a car company by the name of Toyota, okay? They have one of the best quality control mechanisms in all of the auto industry. And part of that is they have a rope that runs along their whole assembly line. And if any one of their workers, things are going too fast or they see a mistake or anything, they can pull on that and stop the whole factory until the problem is fixed. You non-English speakers have that power. Okay? This may be too much power for one person, but you have it. Now, the idea of the metaphor of the, yes, there are seats in the front, of the swimming hole is, I want this to be fun. It's also going to feel like diving into cold water. I'm going to front load you with lots and lots of information, and then we get to have our fun towards the end. But I also hope to show you that popular culture is something we need to take pretty seriously, even as you're having fun. It can be that thing. I'm going to pause every so often for questions and answers, but what I want to do is I want to speak for about half the time, just giving you, just emptying my mind into your mind. And then afterwards, I want to have some time to workshop it, that is, give you movie clips or a song and have us discuss them. I have way more material than we have time for. I mean, way more movie clips and stuff. So we will get to what we get to. But so if there's anybody who has like really long and tortured and so-and-so questions, Every minute that we take from it is a minute less we have to talk about the stuff we have to talk about. I'm hoping that what I say isn't all that controversial. It may be. It's not controversial to me. So anyway, in the next 90 minutes, or 80 minutes, we will be doing four things. Oh, wait, I almost forgot. For those of you who have outlines, they're wrong. Because I was certifiably... Yeah, well, okay, they're not functioning within the context the way they ought to function. Because when I made this outline that you have, I was certifiably insane. So this is a much saner outline. It's also more detailed, which will help the non-English speakers and will help us move at a faster pace. All right, so we're going to do four things. Number one, I'm going to talk about the difference a little bit between modernism and postmodernity. If we get that distinction clear, it should also become clear why certain traditional apologetics may not work as well in a postmodern context as worked in a modern context. And something that will pop up as very suggestive will be popular culture as a means to an apologetic, which will raise the question, so what is this popular culture anyway? You may think you know, but so I'm going to lay out a brief theology of popular culture for you. How are Christians to think of popular culture? There's a lot of nutty ideas about popular culture out there, a lot of them from Christians. Once we get to that, I'm going to give you a short method for how to think through and how to understand popular culture in an apologetic way. And then, finally, we'll workshop and we'll have fun. That's the plan. So, let's launch in, shall we? The shift from the modern worldview to the postmodern worldview is one from a secular mindset to a pluralized mindset. From one that sees all truth as material and there's no room for the spiritual, to one where there's all sorts of room for the spiritual, but there's all sorts of room for everything. And it's very suspicious of any final truth claims. So I want to quickly review the shift from modernism to postmodernism. Modernism is a social and philosophical movement that broke up the shared, overarching meaning system that dominated Christendom for hundreds and hundreds of years. This is what sociologist Peter Berger called the sacred canopy. Once upon a time in Europe, people basically had this broad agreement about what life was all about. And then, with the rise of modern science and the rise of the Industrial Revolution, that canopy started breaking up, both sociologically and philosophically. The new modern perspective on truth and reality developed. For modernism, truth is, number one, autonomous. That is, man's reason must be free to explore and to make its own reason. It needs no outside help. It doesn't need a divine revelation. All we need is what's in here. Okay? Number two, truth is objective and neutral. Truth is seen as something that is unitary, globally unitary. It's the same everywhere. It transcends my personal situation. It doesn't matter when, where, how, why I lived. Truth is truth. And third, truth is dependent upon technique. If I use the right techniques, I will arrive at truth. You know, Descartes, if you start from a bottom line and build by clear and distinct propositions, you will arrive at this architecture of truth. And certainty, truth depends upon your technique. That's why science works. We don't need these fairy tales from a religious book. What we need is a careful and precise technique. So the picture of modern man's identity, and identity is going to be a major theme in this, his sense of self and his relationship to the world is one of a sovereign, autonomous self who analyzes by abstracting from the world around him in order to arrive at a universal truth. This is a fixed identity. It doesn't move around. You are who you are. You are a rational being, and you process information. During modernism, this unifying canopy that I talked about, this meaning-given system, is replaced by science, efficiency, technique, and reason. This is what Peter Berger calls a world without windows. There is no transcendent perspective. It's everything outside the spirit world, anything that would tell us from outside who we are. We've lost contact with that. Real truth has no space for myths and fairy tales. For some of the most hardline modernists, this is a good thing. Religion is something that ought to be gotten rid of. And for me, the paradigmatic hardcore modernist is John Lennon. If you know I'm serious. If you know his song Imagine, imagine there's no heaven, it's easy if you try, no hell below us, above us only sky, imagine all the people living for today, ooh, 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 you may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one, someday you'll join us and the world will be as one. That is, it's actually a song about not imagining. Please, please don't imagine these religious things that are bad for humanity. Instead, lose that, just imagine that it's all that you can see is what there is, and the world will be as one because people won't be fighting anymore. So what does this have to do with apologetics? In this modern situation, the best way to fight unbelief might be head on, as it were. You know, you think that the Christian faith is not rational. Let me show you how rational it is. You don't think it has any scientific evidence. Let me show you the scientific evidence, and so on and so forth. But in late modernity, and there's debates as to what exactly that means. Some people say we're still in late modernity. This modern perspective starts changing a little bit. The reason is because rationality and technique and science and all that stuff cannot provide meaning. It can't really replace what it broke up. And so people start trying to find meaning in all sorts of other ways, all sorts of other places. You know, personal freedom, sex, different types of New Age religion, material wealth, consumerism, all of those start cropping up in late modernity. But all of these pursuits, note, are seen as optional. They are operative in the realm of private opinion. They are not scientific, not practical, not real. So you see this blend of modernity and this creeping up of this postmodern plural thing. And in that way, modernity lays the seeds of postmodernity. As the nature of truth and identity changes, I'm not saying that truth changes. Truth, I mean, in a certain sense, truth is truth, depending on how you define it. But as the perceptions of truth and identity change, I think apologetics has to adapt. What worked for the secular modernist, you know, scientific-like evidences and these sorts of things, may not work with postmoderns. It's a different ball game now. And let me explain some of the reasons why it might be so different. Now I'm going to tell you some stuff about postmodernity. We're going to leave to the side, I mean, one of the issues that's come up in this conference is the postmodernists versus the modernists and stuff like that. I'm going to leave to the side which is right. Personally, I think there's a lot to be gained from both perspectives, and I don't like being forced to choose among them. But I just want to be completely descriptive. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. For those of you at home, he just said I'm a postmodernist, relativist, pig dog. So, um, So this is just completely descriptive. All right? Post-modernity, it's important to note, is not a completely different thing from modernity. It is rather modernity gone to seed, but it flowers into some very new sorts of attitudes. These attitudes are shaped by two pillars, two social realities. And here I'm drawing a lot from sociologist David Lyon's book, Jesus in Disneyland, which I would recommend to you. It's a really, really helpful treatment of this. So the two things that postmodernity is shaped by is, number one, new media technologies, and number two, a consumer-dominated society, or consumerism that dominates society. I used to be very enamored with philosophical descriptions of postmodernisms, you know, meta-narratives and all that sort of stuff. I like this description because it deals more with where people actually live. You know, not everybody out there knows what a meta-narrative is, even if they're relativists, but everybody watches TV, right? And everybody buys things and is kind of sucked into that consumer mentality. So, let's take number one, the rise of new media technologies. We live in a mediated world unlike any generation before us. Whereas before, social interaction happened through face-to-face conversations or through letters, now we have the mobile telephone and email. Whereas before, we passed on our stories orally or through books, now we get cinema, radio, TV, and the internet. Postmoderns exist in a world saturated with media messages. And in dialogue with these messages, they negotiate meaning. Negotiate's a big kind of postmodernist world. It means kind of work out. It's a conversational sort of word. They work out, they wrestle out meanings in dialogue with these media messages. The net effect, pun intended, of this is twofold. Number one, the media messages tend to question and problematize traditional authorities like the church, like science. And sometimes they do this not merely through anti-church or relativistic content, but by the sheer volume of the flow of information. How can there be one perspective that claims to be absolutely true when we receive so many messages from so many different perspectives, each one claiming to be true in a way? There's an Islamic cultural critic who said, the danger for Islam is not from Jesus, but from Madonna. In other words, it's not the Christians who are the real threat now, it's the media. It's this globalized media. Second, these media messages and stories provide frames through which we organize experience. That is, they shape worldview. The media provides us with a sense of what's real, and paradoxically, it blurs the line between real and unreal because there are so many spins to reality. When you see the news, you think you're seeing reality? Haha, think again. You are seeing a certain slant on the news, and postmoderns pick up on that. They know that. They're kind of comfortable. That's their world. But the net effect of that is that that the distinction between real, original, and image is blurred. So Jean Baudrillard calls this simulacra. You know, in a postmodern world, there is no more original thing from which the image is made. It's just an image of an image of an image of an image. This is one of the reasons why I believe this meaning organizing function of the media is one of the reasons I believe popular culture is so important. It's so important for apologetics to be in dialogue with media and popular culture, because it's just here that meaning is made in our culture, in our cultures. These media messages shape our identity, our sense of self. And because there's such a panoply, such a range of meanings, identity is not going to be fixed. Rather, for postmoderns, it's fluid, it's in process. That is, we are always constructing and reconstructing ourselves through the messages we take in and use for our identity. Identity for postmoderns is often fragmentary, shifting from one context to another. You're one person at home, you're another person at school. You're five different people when you're on the web, depending on which chat room you're in. So the net effect, the overall effect of the rise of media technologies is to destabilize, question authority and destabilize identity. All right, let's talk about consumerism for a little bit. Everybody tracking with me so far? Yes? Good. The rise of consumerism. The messages that of these new media technologies are mostly, if not wholly, consumer-oriented. They are they're commercial in nature. Most of the media messages we receive are marketing in one form or another. Everything now can be marketed and commodified, that is, made into a consumer product, including religious faith. So if the barrage of messages from these new media technologies help fragment postmodern identity, what ties it together? Well, David Lyons says, consumerism ties it together. But it does not tie it together in a fixed, stable, modernist sort of way. It ties it together in some very interesting ways. Which I'll explain a little later. So what does it mean to live in a consumer-dominated culture? Well, for one, it changes the way you define yourself. Time was when all people would define themselves in terms of what they produce, their job. You know, who am I? I'm Jack the farmer. I'm, you know, Tracy the pharmacist assistant or whatever. But now, there's been a shift where a lot of people, younger people especially, are more apt to define themselves in terms of their lifestyle, their entertainment options, where you go on vacation. It's a lot more image conscious now. This emphasis on image and success, what car you drive, what apartment you live in, where you go on vacation, et cetera, and so forth, comes from this shift in identity away from a producer orientation to a consumer orientation. This new consumer-oriented identity has two aspects. Number one, the plastic self, Lyon says. That is, identity is completely changeable. It's flexible. It's able to be bent and shaped to our desire. Identity is something we try on, like new clothes, new hairstyle. For postmoderns, even sexual partners or marriages can be tried on and then discarded when they no longer suit your purpose. So the idea is to expand your horizons, taste and flex and be as flexible as you can be so you can be all that you can be. That's an American commercial, by the way. So this is the consumer. This is consumer choice applied to identity. But paradoxically, the other aspect of consumerist identity longs for authenticity. This is what Lyons calls the expressive self. And it seeks, rather than expansion, it seeks a deepening of, it seeks a depth through an ongoing enrichment of an inner story. That is, my inner story progresses in such a way that my identity is enriched as I go along. This sort of identity longs for validation, but not from an external authority like science or like the church, but rather an authenticity from within. That expressive self longs to find something that harmonizes with that inner voice and completes the inner story. Of course, the plastic self, with its tendency for expansion and for shallowness, and the expressive self, with its tendency for inner depth and for self-absorption, coalesce, that is, they come together in any number of ways. The New Age has made a science out of how to put the two together. That is, how to deepen your own inner experience and identity through trying and all these different things, by gaining new experiences. Now, not all postmodernists are New Agers, but all are marked to some extent by this sort of twofold consumerist identity. So, let's put all of this together. The effect of the new media technologies and consumerism on identity can be summarized by saying that the postmodernist person is one who, number one, is suspicious of external authority, whether science or the church. Number two, is suspicious of claims to absolute truth. There are too many such claims coming in from media venues all over the place. And number three, he or she has problems with the concept of absolute reality, since the media so often blurs these distinctions so that fact and fiction often blend. Number four, they may not see themselves as a single stable identity, but rather as a fluid identity in process, or even identities in process. But always, always, always at the core, a sort of consumer who is picking and choosing as they're going along this process. And yet, five, he or she longs for authenticity and unity, a completion to their personal story. Now, if you're trying to reach these people, traditional apologetics might not be your best bet. Traditional apologetics tends to be direct and demonstrative. Listen, you unbeliever. What you need is you need to know that the historical evidence is that Jesus really rose again from the dead, and then you'll believe that God is real. But for many postmoderns, that sort of argument is a non-starter because, for one, it ignores who they are. It ignores their story and tries to impose an external authority on them, and in this case, the authority of historical evidence, a very modernist type of authority, in order to support an absolute truth that they suspect doesn't exist. It is more likely to cause resentment and distance than persuasion. What is needed is a more flexible apologetic that can be, number one, indirect rather than direct. That is, dialogical, conversational, questioning, Socratic. Asking more questions than providing quick answers. Although there is a place for providing answers. It needs to be a listening apologetic. You need to be able to hear their story, to be able to hear them interact with what you're saying. Otherwise, what you have to say to them will be alien and completely irrelevant, whether you think it's true with a capital T or not. Number two, apologetics must be, for a postmodern context, must be elusive. That is allusive, not illusionary, but allusive and suggestive, rather than demonstrative. For postmoderns, apologetics needs to be a gentle conversation about meanings and interpretations of reality. Proving something for a postmodern isn't necessarily proving something in the modernist sense. Let's say that you prove to this person that Jesus really did rise from the dead. Have you won then, in any sense of the word? No, they can come back and say, well, lots of holy people rise from the dead. You know, what you are in fact arguing for is not simply for the fact of the resurrection. You are arguing that the biblical interpretation, that is the meaning of this fact within the Christian worldview, is the right and good and true and beautiful one. That the Christian worldview essentially is worth believing in. That is a much more subtle and difficult thing to establish than simply saying, this thing happened in history. What does this thing mean? So you need to not simply, and maybe not even primarily convince them that Christianity is true. Rather, you need to be able to say the Christian worldview casts a light on their own story that illuminates where other narratives have not. And that's not to say you can discard truth altogether. I would never want to say that. But at least in my experience, truth becomes an issue down the line in the apologetic process. It is not what you lead with. Yeah, I'm breaking down. Okay, fine. Thanks. It's open. I know, I'm sorry. It's all my hot air. All right, so this is why popular culture, we're coming to popular culture at last. This is why popular culture is so important. Popular culture can be an entree into the world of the postmodern, into the world of the postmodern person, for it too works on the level of feeling, attitude, allusion, through its use of stories, images, and rhythms. Popular culture can be a bridge, to use Elaine Storkey's metaphor, if you guys heard her last year, for those of you who are here. It can be a bridge into their world, and the postmoderns keenly feel the need for such a connection. Because the result of this fragmentation and consumerist flexibility in postmodern identity often leads to loneliness, isolation, a feel of being lost in the world. Postmoderns want someone to enter into their world, and they want to experience, they want the experience of entering into somebody else's world. I want to play a song for you. It's by a group called Benfolds Five, and who are popular in the States a couple of years ago. And I think it provides a really good illustration of the postmodernist dilemma. And for the song, I'm going to turn this off.
Slumped over in a vacant room, held a stranger's name, and she's back up.
What were some of the themes in that song that you picked up?
Being free and sad at the same time.
That's key. If you read between the lines, it's a song of abandonment. You know, remember when he says, why is it that all men, you know, been thinking about my old man, it seems that all men like to get into a car and go anywhere. What's he talking about? My dad left me. My dad went away. And in another sense, he's talking about God has gone away. I mean, you can read, no God, what have I done? You can say, no God, what have I done? Or, no God, what have I done? There's a sense that, you know, he's grown up, he's mature, he's landed this record deal, he's got success. And in a sense, he's free, but he has no direction. He's got no community. Those incredibly poignant metaphors at the end, you know, maybe I'm a blind man on a canyon's edge of a panoramic scene, or maybe I'm a kite dangling high on a string, or maybe I'm, what was the last one? Yeah, or slumped over in a vacant room, head on a stranger's knee.
I'm sorry, no native speaker.
Yeah, yeah.
What's kite?
Kite, drak. Drak. It's, yeah. So you have this idea that I'm free, I don't have any of these boundaries anymore, but so what? I am absolutely alone.
Yeah, the kite imagery is very powerful because a kite needs to be anchored.
Uh-huh.
Freedom is in the anchoring, but he's saying a dangling string. So that's good.
Yeah.
The freedom has gone crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, these are people that want someone to enter into their world, are looking for that connection, and want to enter into somebody else's world, are looking for that connection. So, if popular culture is a good venue for doing this, we need a way to interpret it, a way to understand it. So I'm going to lay out very, very briefly a kind of a theology of popular culture. And that's just to say this. Popular culture bears the traits of the people who made it. Who are human beings? If you want to understand what popular culture is, you have to have a good biblical anthropology. All right? We are created in God's image. What does that mean? It means, number one, we are created uniquely among all creatures to have a relationship with God. Okay, so here's man, to have this kind of relationship. What does that mean? That means people have a fundamental religious orientation. We should expect popular culture to have a religious orientation. People were created to be dazzled, to find something in something beyond themselves. We are worshiping beings. Popular culture, too, is worship of a sort, if you know how to look for it. Number two, we are creative beings. God is a creator. He created us. We are creative beings. That is, we are to use his creation in order to do creative things. You know, build guitars, play them, build houses. So we have this kind of expressive creative element as well. Now, these two aspects of the image go to... I'm sorry, back up. So popular culture is simply part of this creative expressivity of human beings. Now, these two aspects of the image go together, don't they? How were we originally intended to use this creativity? We were intended to use it for the worship of God and to love and serve our fellow creatures, especially our fellow image-bearing creatures. But we're not only created in the image of God, we are fallen beings. What does that mean? That means, number one, that our religious orientation has become warped. And instead of
Instead of worshiping God, we worship idols. Furthermore, our creativity has been warped. Instead of loving and serving other creatures, we tend to love and serve ourselves. So these idols, they're not, you guys are savvy enough, they're not just little pieces of wood or whatever. They can be anything that can serve as a substitute for God. You know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, prestige, power, money, whatever, reputation, family, whatever it is that your heart orbits around, including self. Therefore, in popular culture, what should we expect? We should expect some of that idolatrous twisting, shouldn't we? And that's not very hard to see. That's Christians, evangelical Christians, get this part really, really well. They like to see idolatry. They get that. But that's not the end of the story. God did not abandon the world to just this twisting, did he? He left testimonies of himself and his goodness all over the place. Theologians call this common grace. And if you want to know more about common grace, I suggest you read Paul's address to the Lystrans in Acts 14, you know, where he says, God has, when the Lystrans try to, I'm talking about it, I love how speakers tell you they don't have time to talk about it, and then they talk about it. The Lystrans, thinking that Paul and Apollos are gods, sacrifice them, and he says, no. Lystrans, we have been sent to you to tell you to turn from this thing. In the past, you know, people did this, but God has left testimonies. God has left a witness by giving you rains and food and has put joy in your hearts to tell you to turn from these worthless things to the true and living God. That's common grace. So the fact is, common grace means that there are all these pointers to God. All of these pointers to God. That's what common grace does. We should expect, in popular culture, made by image bearers of God, to find these traces of grace that point beyond themselves to God. That's the thing that evangelicals often miss in popular culture. And it cheeses me off to no end. sorry, got violent. Rozčilení. Finally, we human beings are interpretive beings. You know, God has set eternity in our hearts, and we do our darndest to try to figure it out, don't we? We live in a world surrounded by God's revelation, and we want to try to put that together into meaning sets for ourselves. We like to put our own spin on popular culture. Popular culture, likewise, is an interpretive cultural activity. When someone creates a movie or a song or a book, what they are doing is creating a little world of meaning and inviting you in and say, come, look around. And that interaction between you and this world changes you at the level of identity, just ever so subtly. I mean, do you feel it when you go to the movies? I think the last really powerful cinematic experience I had was going to the first Lord of the Rings movie. You know, and you sit in there, and you're in a different world. And then towards the end of the movie, Aragorn says, "Let's go hunt some orc." And the credits start rolling, and you say, "No, take me with you! I want to hunt orcs too!" And the lights come up. The lights come up, and suddenly you're back in your own world. But part of you is changed, isn't it? Oh, and then you're going, no! You know, that is the trial of the real world, isn't it? But you walk out into the bright sunlight, and you say, you know, where have I been? I feel different. That's what popular culture does. So, popular culture reflects this human complexity. It is not just all bad. It is not just all good and wonderful. It is a complex interpretive package that we have to take great care to interpret correctly. Doing the typical evangelical thing of it's bad, it's got sex and violence in it and stuff like that, you know, and therefore it's yucky, that won't do. It just won't. It may have yucky stuff in it. I'm not denying that, but it just won't do as a response. And likewise, the other typical evangelical response, that it's too trivial really to think about, that won't do either. Rather, we have to think of a different way, one that matches the complexity of popular culture. So I'm going to give you 5 steps for interpreting popular culture. This is not a 5-step method. I mean, it is sort of. I mean, one step builds upon the next step. But what I'm giving you more is a perspective. Sometimes maybe you're really going to hammer on step 4. Sometimes maybe you're going to really hammer on step 3 or whatever. Don't think of it as you have to do this robotic-like or it just won't work. But I did try to simplify it in order to make it fairly easy to remember. Number 1, what is the story? Get the story straight. All right? This is very important, especially if you're dealing in Europe with non-native English speakers and you're watching like an English language movie. When I do movie discussion nights, we spend a good deal of time just making sure everybody's on the same page. Everybody knows what happened in the story. And when you're doing a movie like Magnolia or 13 Conversations About One Thing, that can be a chore, you know, because they're very complex narrative structures. So be familiar with the plot and the characters and stuff like that, okay? That's the baseline. Why? Because popular culture, at least in the West, tends to be narrative in format. And these are the ways meaning are communicated, is through stories. Number 2, say, where am I? What sort of world have I gotten myself into? What counts as good and what counts as bad? What makes relationships work? What makes them fail? All these sorts of questions. You start asking questions, trying to find out the landscape. Take a look around you. What kind of world is this? You know, what are the major themes that dominate? What are the motifs that you notice in here? You know, this, folks, if any of you out there graduated with an English or a literature degree and everybody said to you, what are you going to do with that? You know, that was my personal, you know, cross to bear. This is what you do with it, all right? You literature people out there have an advantage because you're trained to look for this stuff. You non-lit people out there, you have to start self-consciously looking for symbols and connections. And this is, I'm getting ahead of myself. This is what I'd call cultural analysis. It's not rocket science, but it does take some thinking and reflection. So you want to penetrate into the very structure of what this world is presenting. That is, into its worldview. Worldview isn't thought of as a set of propositions. It is thought of the structure of this world through which reality is being seen. These worlds are models. Yes?
You say ask questions. What questions would you ask about the nature of this world?
Just what I've been saying. What's important? Where's the center of gravity? What's the center of gravity and what are the satellites, so to speak? What's good? What's true? The aesthetic of the world. I mean, all of these, you know, what sort of, if you're watching a movie, I mean, each of this is, of course, genre specific, right? So what sort of language is being used in a popular piece of popular fiction? What sort of rhetorical figures are being used? Or in cinema, what sort of camera angles are being used and what are they communicating? Or in music, what sort of chord changes are being used and what do they mean? These are they can be very complex and you can't, a lot of times it'll come down to texture. Feeling. It's an interpretive activity. It is not a science. Okay? So, I could go on with that, but I want to push on. All right, so these worlds are models of reality and for reality. What is this author think reality is? What does he or she think reality ought to be? Both of those are combined in this world that you're penetrating. Question number three, what's true and good and beautiful and right here? You have to be very careful. There are going to be things like that. There are going to be things like that unless you're dealing with the darkest, most perverse, nasty thing out there. That's what I call these moments the footprints of God. And you have to be very careful to handle them well because they are gifts of God and you ignore them at your peril. If you just say, oh, this piece of popular culture is trash, and you don't pay attention to it, you are ignoring and being ungrateful to God himself. You have to be very careful with this. This is what I was talking about when I was saying when I was talking about the elusiveness of popular culture. What are the connections you would draw between this thing that is obviously good, this aspect of this world that's obviously good, and God himself? What are these connections? Sometimes it will be symbolic. Sometimes it will be very, very direct. Number four, of course, these worlds are not going to be all goodness and truth and light and milk and honey. There's also going to be stuff that's false and ugly and perverse in it. And your next question is to ask, okay, what's false? What's ugly? What's perverse? And how do I subvert that?
Could you elaborate on what you mean by subvert?
Yes, I'm going to get to that. I have something very specific in mind. Where does this world lie? Now, for this task, there is no better tool than just a good basic knowledge of the Bible. If you know your Bible, what you are knowing is you are knowing the mind of God, the heart of God. And what that does is it's like a museum that has like the infrared things, and when an intruder comes in, you get, nah. All right, when you hear those alarm bells going off in your head, if you know the Bible, you know something's wrong, and you have to start asking some questions, maybe some very theological questions. What's functioning as God here? What's the idol? Where am I being slipped the Mickey, you know, as the Americans would say? I am an American, so I'm saying it. Interestingly, the true and good and beautiful stuff often has an organic connection to the idol. Why is that? Because that's the way idols work. An idol does not come at you and go, "Bleh, I'm an idol." No. An idol says, "Come here." In America, we have a saying: "You attract more flies with honey than with vinegar." It's the sweetness, the light, that will get you, draw you in, and you land your little fly body on that, and all of a sudden you say, "Wait a minute, I'm trapped." And so you'll see a movie that will show you contentment coming from having the good things, and it will trap you into thinking what 98% of Europe thinks, that happiness can be bought. Or you will listen to a song where guy meets girl and everything's wonderful, and it will trap you into thinking, I can have eternal happiness if I just have the right girl or the right guy. This is what I call the ideology of romance. It's very prevalent. Or in my house, it goes by the code name, the power of love. If ever in a movie you can say, "Oh, the power of love," then you know that's what you got. So what this does is you have these common grace moments. What idolatry does is it redirects it and says, this good and true and beautiful thing, that's not a gift of God. It's a gift of me, your friendly neighborhood idol. And your job as an apologist is to go in and liberate that good and true and beautiful thing and return it to its original context. One of the things I say when I talk about apologetics is your job as an apologist is to be like an eco-terrorist. there are these animals, these good and true and beautiful animals, good and true and beautiful animals, and they're kept in bars. They're trapped in this alien system. Your job is to go in, plant some explosives, blow the thing to bits so the animals can romp and go free and return to their natural habitat. That's what you're doing. You're going to the common grace, and you're saying, huh, what is this? Where did this come from? You mean to say that this idol really can account for this good and true and beautiful thing? That's what I mean by subversion. Yes?
Do you also think that, like, as you've said before, like, lots of evangelicals look at things and go, oh, it's evil, it's really bad, or don't really enjoy things? I think non-Christians and popular culture can help on that.
Yeah.
Whereas if we looked for the really cool common grace things, we'd learn to enjoy them.
Yes.
Like, truly enjoy them on another level, then people would pick up on that and take it more seriously, enjoy being in our company. And
enjoy being in our company because we're not so closed anymore. We're just, I mean, evangelicals, just chill out. Just enjoy what God's given you, please. The making connections with people, especially postmodern, depends on that. That does not mean that you can ever lose your critical edge either. That's kind of the. I came to this realization when I was in seminary. I started thinking, you mean I can't really enjoy anything uncritically anymore? And to a certain extent, you can. I mean, that's always the first step of interpretation, is just kind of, opening. You don't want to just jump on it and say, aha, I see this consistency. I see this inconsistency. This one, you want to just let it kind of hit you, and let it affect you, and then later step back and start processing it. Which is why, by the way, if you do a movie night or something, always see something twice. I've only ever done a movie night where I showed the movie I was seeing for the first time. And it really worked because I got a really good, strong recommendation on it. And it was a great movie, which I have a clip of. But I would just, if you're going to lead that sort of discussion, give yourself time to process before you do it in front of other people. So what you're doing is you're saying, look at this true and beautiful thing. It's a lie that it comes from here. It comes from this idol. And the interesting thing is, with postmoderns, they're used to marketing. So a lot of times they're going to agree with you. If you say this gently and humbly, can you see how this doesn't really lead to that? They'll say, yeah, I can see that. That makes sense. Because they're used to dealing with things that are only half true anyway. And the beautiful thing about this is you can lead them now to the real source of it. And that leads me to the last step. How does the gospel apply? The final step is to show how the gospel responds to popular culture. When a piece of popular culture really works, it's because it stirs human desires. Desires for good things, true love, reconciliation, contentment, security, family, forgiveness. Though it often does this by providing an idolatrous source for those. But the gospel can provide real answers to that. Real contentment does not come in a cigarette. It comes in relationship and in the absolute relationship that one has when he or she is walking with Christ. The detective's thirst for justice, where does that come from? It is a reflection of our deep-seated need to see this world that has been twisted and made wrong be made right. Who's going to make it right? God promised that he's going to make it right and is doing so through his son Jesus, who laid the foundation, and then through his people who are to be peacemakers and righteousness makers and justice doers in the world. In order to understand this last step, you have to get away from a narrow definition of the gospel. The gospel is not simply that Jesus came 2,000 years ago to die for you on the cross so you could have forgiveness of sins. That is the center and the core of the gospel, and you need to be moving towards it. But that fact, that center, explodes into all sorts of implications for all sorts of life. It means a new sort of life, a new power, a new world, new creation, Paul talks about. That means that that you're going to have a whole new perspective with all of these implications, and that's what you're communicating. Bruce Coburn, the Christian Canadian singer-songwriter, has this song called Child of the Wind, and it goes, little round planet in a big universe, sometimes it looks blessed, sometimes it looks cursed. Depends on what you look at, obviously, but it depends on the way that you see. The gospel means that you have a whole new way of seeing reality. Therefore, when you see signals of forgiveness and new peace and things like that, you know where it comes from, in a sense. The implications of this broad applicability of the gospel for your apologetics means you don't have to force a gospel presentation. You don't have to force the four spiritual laws every time you do this. You can do it bit by bit. I like to think of when I'm doing one of these movie nights that I am seeing the gospel as a gem with many, many facets. And every time we discuss a piece of popular culture, I get to turn the gem a little bit and let it glint in the light for just a little bit and show what the Christian worldview says about sex, says about materialism and economic justice, says about the dignity of people. And if you do this over a period of time, and it will take time, sooner or later, people will start getting a feel for what the Christian worldview is. There are some times when it's going to lead directly to the gospel, and that's good. But you don't need to feel that pressure to always go there. Let me go through this last part very, very quickly. How to use popular culture to reach postmoderns. That last word of the title of the presentation. First of all, being in touch with the significant works of popular culture gives you a map of the heart of the postmodern. So you need to be in touch in that way. Also, popular culture provides a screen upon which you can project the human heart and talk about it without threatening somebody else. I was at Michael Ramsden's workshop yesterday. Brilliant stuff, conversational apologetics, asking questions, cutting to the chase of what is the real issue. But I was saying, man, that's aggressive stuff. You better know the person really well. At least in the Czech Republic, you've got to know the person really well if you start, you know, what's the real issue of your not coming to Christ? You know, asking those sorts of questions. What you can do in popular culture is you see a narrative. You see Mr. Hero. He's struggling with things. And that resonates with the heart of the people that you're dealing with. If it's a good movie. And you can say, well, what's his problem? You know, where is he going? What's happening here? And in that way, you know, you're kind of doing the, I have a friend who has this sort of problem, and I really want your opinion about this imaginary friend or something like that. You can do that. That's popular culture. Think about hosting events where you can use popular culture in this way. I try to have one of these events every couple of weeks because I have a personal theology of partying. Jesus was a party animal. He was. He got run down by the Pharisees for hanging around and partying with people all the time. And if non-Christians could know what we know about what forgiveness we have, what joy we have, what freedom we have, why wouldn't you want to throw a party and invite other people in? So throw parties, show movies, do whatever. I'm not by nature a party animal. I'm kind of reserved and quiet, as you can tell. But it's true. But it's a good thing, just having parties, showing movies. Be aware that not all popular culture is appropriate for discussion. If watching something is going to make you feel dirty, it's really hard to discuss the gospel when you watch something like that. Also, I am not saying that all popular culture everywhere is great and needs microscopic inspection. There's some trash out there. There's ear candy and eye candy out there. Look for the pieces that have depth. Look for the pieces of popular culture that is depth, because it is a lie that there is nothing out there being written and performed. There is some brilliant stuff out there, brilliant stuff being performed at the popular level, stuff that brings out the real human issues. You know, death, life and death, betrayal, love, forgiveness, guilt, friendship, separation, all of these things that are fertile ground. All right. We've got a little bit of time left. I'm going to show, who here has seen Magnolia? That's not enough of you. It's not a perfect movie. It's very long. It's very narratively complex. And I got to say this now. If anybody is very offended by bad language, you might want to leave now, because I'm not going to show the Tom Cruise section, but there is some language in here, and that's actually part of the discussion. So let me set up this clip for you, and I got to turn this off now. Yes, I hope so. It's a 5 minute clip, less than 5 minutes. So this may be the only clip we get to, but we'll see. And if you guys want to hang around and do this more, you know, it can't be taped. But, you know, don't tell anybody to do that. All right, let me set up the clip. We're going to see mostly two characters. One named Jim. He's a policeman. He's a Christian. And he's presented as not all that bright, but just a kind of nice, really nice, solid guy. He comes to answer a call of public disturbance at the apartment of Claudia. Claudia is really, really messed up. She is addicted to cocaine. She sleeps with older men who supply her with cocaine. You're going to need it to see the movie. And there's a piece of information that kind of explains why she's kind of as messed up as she is. So most of it is Jim comes to check out this disturbance because she's playing her stereo too loud, and she's meanwhile doing lines, snorting lines of cocaine, and it's the police, open up, and she's throwing things and hiding things, and he comes in and gives her a lecture about how she needs to keep her stereo down because of her neighbors, and then he leaves and he comes back and he says, you know, I really just want to ask you for a date. He's divorced, and I just want to ask you for a date. I feel bad because I'm a policeman. I came here on business, but I just got to ask you for a date. And she says, it's really funny. She says, would that be against the law? And he said, well, yeah, sort of. And she says, fine, I want to do it. and so this is a restaurant scene. Sandwiched in between these two restaurant scenes, you will see Claudia's parents, Jimmy Gator, and I forget the wife's name. Jimmy Gator is a game show host. He has cancer, and he has come home after the game show and confessed to his wife that he has committed adultery, that he's been unfaithful to her because he wants a clean slate before he dies. But there are other secrets that need to be discussed. So, with that in mind, do you guys want me to kill the lights, or is this fine? Why don't we kill the lights? Can somebody just duck out in the... Yeah.
There, great.
Did you ever go out with someone and just lie? Question after question? Maybe you're trying to make yourself look cool or better than you are or whatever. Smarter, cooler. And you just... not really lie, but maybe you just don't say anything.
Well, that's a natural thing. You know, two people go out on a date or something. They want to impress people. The other person, or they're scared that they might say something that might the other person not like them.
Thank you. So you
don't. I don't go out very often.
Why not?
I never found someone really that I think I'd like to go out with.
And they say that to all the girls, huh?
No.
Want me to deal with me?
Okay.
What I just said. People are afraid to say things. No one gets to say the things that they, that are real or something.
Yeah.
To not do that. To not do that, that maybe we've done before.
Let's make a deal.
Okay. I'll tell you everything. And you tell me everything. And maybe we can get through all the piss and shit and lies that kill other people.
Wow. Huh. Piss and shit.
What?
I didn't really use strong language.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
I didn't mean... it seems vulgar, something I know.
It's fine.
No, I'm sorry.
No, it's nothing. I'm sorry.
I'm gonna rest the bathroom for a minute, maybe just...
Okay.
She's going to the bathroom to do some cocaine because she's so nervous.
I wanted to do that.
Well...
I felt good to do what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Can I tell you something?
Yeah, of course.
I'm really nervous that you're going to hate me soon. You're going to find stuff out about me and you're going to hate me.
No, what do you mean?
You have so much, so many good things, and you seem so together. You're a police officer, and you seem so straight and put together without any problems.
I lost my gun today.
What?
I lost my gun today when I left you. I'm the laughing stock of a lot of people. I wanted to tell you. I wanted you to know. And it's on my mind. That makes me look like a fool. I feel like a fool. And you asked that we should say things, that we should say what we're thinking and not lie about things. Well, I can tell you that I lost my gun today. I'm not a good cop. I'm looked down at, and I know that, and I'm scared that once you find that out, you might not like me.
Jim, that was so great, what you just said.
I haven't been on a date since I was married, and that was 3 years ago. And Claudia, whatever you want to tell me, whatever you think might scare me, won't. And I will listen to you. I'll be a good listener to you if that's what you want. You know, I won't judge you. I know I can do that sometimes, and I won't. And I can listen. And you shouldn't be scared of scaring me off or whatever you think that I think, and on, you should just say it, whatever it is, and I'll listen to you.
You know how fucking stupid I am.
It's okay.
You don't know how crazy I am.
It's okay.
I've got troubles, okay?
I'll take everything at face value. I'll be a good listener to you.
I started this, didn't I? Fuck.
Whatever it is, just say it. You'll see.
You want to kiss me, Jim?
Yes, I do.
Say it, Jim.
I think she thinks that I may have molested her.
They're talking about Claudia.
I think terrible things have somehow got into her head that I may have done. She said that to me last time when I was 10 years ago. She walked out the door, you touched me wrong, I know that. Some crazy thought in her head.
Did you ever touch her? But you can't say.
Well, I don't know.
Oh, yes, you do. You do. But you won't say.
I don't know. What? Sir, please. Please.
You deserve to die alone for what you've done.
I don't know what I've done.
Yes, you do.
Rose, if I said that I knew, would you say?
No!
But I don't know what I've done.
You should know better!
Now that I've met you, would you object to never seeing me again?
What?
Just say no.
I won't say no.
Just say no.
Wait, call it. Call it.
Just let me go.
Call it.
Call it. Just let me go.
Whoops. All right. That's powerful stuff. So let's just, you guys understood the story, right? Because I explained it. So we can skip step one. What sort of world is this? What do you see that's good? What do you see that's false? Let's start with the good stuff. What do you see in there? What would you try to make connection with these postmodern non-Christian folks that you're watching this movie with? Or a lot of times I just let them make the connections. They'll go to it. They know it. They know what they like in it, what's good and true. But what would you see? There's a desire to connect, and at the same time, there's what? Yeah. There's a desperate desire on Claudia's part to be open. She's living this double life, and it's killing her. And she... A desire for honesty? What else?
A fear of connection.
And at the same time, a fear of connection and a fear of honesty. Why?
Because
you might not be loved. Because it's too painful. What?
You've got a formal authority, police officer, who is able to rest on the appearance of authority, and that he's got an opportunity to be vulnerable and it's terrifying to take down that wall.
Okay. Jim in this scene is just the magnitude of his problems, even though they're great. I mean, there's a whole number of scenes where you have police officers walking in a line trying to find the gun that he dropped, and it's actually in the hands of some criminals now, which is not a good thing, you know. But, but the magnitude of that problem compared with Gloria's whole life is a shambles and a wreck. Even the fact that he's willing to be vulnerable, he's this very innocent guy, you know. Oh, you said those words, you know. You know, I have to confess, I was being just a little bit wicked in showing this, because just in case there were any Christians out there who like, alarm bells go off at the wrong things, like, ooh, that was a bad word. You know, look at the way that small thing, how Claudia reacts to it. No, that might have been vulgar. I mean, she has no idea. Her moral compass is just going. She is, and all she cares about is the acceptance of this guy
but some stable point that she can grab hold of. But with his, oh, wow, you use strong language, he's communicating a distance, you know, a pulling back. And Jim, to his credit, you know, says, no, I'm sorry. And later on he says, and I know I can be judgmental, and I know I can do that, but I won't be. You know, and he's desperately trying to bridge that gap with her. And Claudia, it's not that just that it would be painful for her, but here is somebody who's been sexually abused and regularly throws away her sexuality in order to keep her cocaine habit going. She feels incredibly dirty inside, incredibly unworthy. And Jim, I mean, it's powerful stuff. And Jim just wants to move into that brokenness as compassionately, you know, I'll take everything at face value. I would doubt really strongly that he's going to arrest her. He gives clues throughout the rest of the picture that he knows when to forgive, that he will forgive criminals when he thinks it's going to be good and healing for them. You know, so you have this person moving into this brokenness, and you have this terrified response, just let me go, Jimmy, just let me go, just let me go. You know, what is that a picture of? That's Jesus Christ in a movie where they say bad words. I have never or rarely seen that clarity of the gospel presented in popular culture. It's amazing.
Transition.
Yeah, yeah.
Imagine for a minute if we saw that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're saying,
I would say, you know, what do you think Claudia is feeling? You think she's got secrets to hide? Why is she so scared? I know sometimes I have secrets to hide, and I find it really hard to be completely open. I mean, Claudia sets the bar so high. Let's tell each other everything. How many of you here would tell somebody you want to be close with absolutely everything? Is there somebody? Okay, maybe you. all right, there's one in every group. But there's. Is there some? And why? Because you're afraid that there's going to be that distance. Do you think Jim would have done that? You know. Is there somebody who you could be that open with, who's not going to be shocked, who's, you know, and just lead it down that way. Yes? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, would you at that point, or somewhere in there, of course you have to make a judgment call, it's more art than science here, but would you say, and I've been there, would you be a participator, or you just directly, because you could say,
yeah.
I'm there, and I've found,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would say I've done things that I carried around, and that I wanted to get off my chest, but I was scared that, you know, somebody was going to judge me. I've been in Claudia's shoes. I mean, I haven't done drugs and so forth, but I've had that, and probably you have too. And yeah, that would be really good. Yes.
Can I ask for using that for gospel purposes in terms of? I am fully with you. I think all of you said it's absolutely wonderful. My fear is now, just let's take the example there. We're in a discussion with friends, and you then want to say, but look, as Christians, or we just want to say, the gospel means this, and it offers you this. And my fear is the guys who are invited to the media evening just said, all the categories clash.
But see, I wouldn't say that. No. I wouldn't say that.
But at what point, when you invite them, do you say, we will do a Christian critique?
No. I'm sort of in transition about this. When I started doing this, we would do the movie, we'd discuss a little bit, get the story straight, start talking about themes, and then I would give the Christian interpretation, and conversation invariably would come to a crashing halt. That's why I was talking about just showing glimpses. You don't have to show the whole thing. Let them go. But what I would say is, can you see, from a Christian worldview, there is a place where you can be that open. A lot of times I just preface it from a Christian perspective. You know, this is where you go. And I found it to be very powerful and healing as well. That's what people are seeking, healing, yes.
If everyone, because we have similar, in the UK, there's like book groups of being encouraged. Mm-hmm. You get like a popular culture book and you will read it and you kind of give it to your non-Christian mates, as it were, and you will read it together. And everyone's got, because it's, we can't say, oh, this person is a postmodernist, because no one really is a pure postmodernist. Not
right.
Really. Like, some people are, but most people aren't. And so you sit around and you talk about it, and it's in a non-threatening environment. Yeah. You just say, oh, from my perspective, they know you're a Christian, and I should do if they were mates. And so you say, from my perspective, I'm a Christian myth.
Mm-hmm.
And they hear the gospel, and they don't realize they're hearing it, because they think that they're just hearing your opinion as a Christian.
Yeah. Yes.
Tim, I appreciate everything you said, and I also what you said. So that please misunderstand.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I want to shoot in another direction.
Okay.
In Scotland recently, Richard Cunningham went up to the Ridge by Marcus there, and there was a debate on, was it a debate?
Mm-hmm. On the resurrection. Yeah.
400 students did that. I'd just like your take on that. Not to negate what's been said, but just to qualify some of this idea that is around. Because I think it's true that guys are not interested to just get straight. But in a context where they're not having a preach,
yeah.
But it is actually a questioning, like you're doing at this level,
mm-hmm.
It's being done in a very big public area. I'm just fascinated. You heard what John Lennon said last night.
Yeah. No,
what's your take on that?
Well, my first take is, like I said, modernity and postmodernity. It's not, you know, somewhere around 1967, modernity ended, and now we're in postmodernity. You can't have that because so many of the social structures of modernity are, you know, the bureaucratic state, capitalist society, or whatever, are still around. It's going to affect the way people think. So you still have strands of modernity, even as they're mixed in with postmodernity. Therefore, those sorts of things are going to be very, you know, the priesthood of science is still very much a hot issue. It's still very much a live issue. For certain people, for really postmodern people, that may not appeal as much. Also, a debate about the resurrection still depends upon a good deal of Christian cultural capital that's in which you can assume that everybody sort of agrees on what the resurrection means. I have a friend that I took out to breakfast and who's a practicing Buddhist. You know, and I said, well, what do you do with Jesus? And he said, what do you mean, what do I do with Jesus? Well, I mean, what do you do with the resurrection? Well, lots of holy men. You know, that whole dialogue I gave is straight from his mouth. You know, and I said, okay, well, what do you do about the Bible's interpretation of the resurrection, which means that this Jesus is uniquely Lord of the universe? He said, well, of course, I can't buy into that. You know, so there is, among postmoderns, a fundamental disconnect between the fact of the resurrection and the meaning of the resurrection.
I'm interested to say that you express it in terms of modernity here, because why not just as you do in terms of the resonance of a human heart towards the truth, which is that we are lost, man. We couldn't cry that one of the songs that you sang. That's I don't think we have to, I think this is unhelpful to think of as modernity as it is at this point.
Okay, I'm willing.
Magnolia, there's so many themes there of the father, the different fathers, Tom Cruise's father and so on, the result of estrangement from the father. Now, what a huge parable that is.
Yeah.
I mean, that is
absolutely.
All
Absolutely.
What happens when there's no child? Yeah.
I just did not want to show the Tom Cruise, seminar.
Relating to what Ronald was saying, anyway, yeah, sure. But relating to what Ronald was saying, this is the ultimate ache
yeah.
of the human race, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No. There's something universal. I would just say that ache is configured differently in different cultures and maybe in different eras. But I would not want to say there's no universal whatever. One last point, and that is, we're here affirming all this good stuff. Where's the idolatry? Is there idolatry? Well, when they kiss, and she wants to, it's not quite as clear. You can't ever say, except at the very end of the movie, the power of love. But you think, let's say that she really does come clean. Jim's in for a hellish year if he marries this woman and starts trying to get her clean. What sort of sexual relationship is he going to have with his new wife? She's a severely broken person. If they're going to survive, they're going to need a power outside of themselves. They will stay in love for 2 years max. If there's nothing else there, they're going to crumble and fall. The power of love is not self-sustaining. That's one of the things. Yes.
I think this is used in that movie in a very, very ironical context concerning the song in the end and everything.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's. I mean, this is my problem with what you said to identify the symbols in the movie. Because sometimes you just not knowing how to interpret art. You just can't interpret it. I mean, you can interpret it however you want, but especially in connection with what you have just said about the kiss and about how the superficial level of love is expressed in that movie, I think it had very, very ironical context in
oh, sure.
that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds or it points to something very different than they are going to have a relationship.
Well, it depends on if you interpret the last scene ironically or not. I mean, for those of you who haven't seen the movie, Jim finally comes back. Well, and speaks healing words to Claudia, and that's sort of where the movie ends. So you do get this very Christ-like presence. And I didn't think it was a very highly emotionally charged thing. You could read it ironically that, of course, we don't know this is really happening, wink, wink, but the emotions run so strong in this movie, it would be really hard. Now, I am honor-bound to have you guys fill out this thing. And I know that you have to render a on a scale to 1 to 4, quantify it and the whole thing. Yes.
I'm from Scotland as well. We're quite thick in Scotland, at least I can speak for myself.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, I thought what you said was fantastic. Not, I know that you're not saying this is the only way to teach postmodern people. This is another useful tool for us to use. I know that there are so many films that I can sometimes just glimpse what you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
But how can I access a worked examples? Do you have any sort of worked examples from the web, or is there any other way? Someone could teach me how to do that, because I'd love to learn how to do that. But I don't think I'm insightful enough to go away and practice it more.
I would just watch lots of movies and just kind of, I mean, I laid it out as a 5-step plan so that you could mentally do that and be that mechanical at the beginning. Until you develop instincts.
Can I put in a for the Demise website, because it's just the sort of thing.
Okay.
The Connect Bible studies. And
sure.
That you are kind of self-oriented what you're saying. So
yeah.
Would you say that there are people who are much naturally better at connecting with people in the culture?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, God gifts people differently.
It just seems a bit contrived to learn how to.
But no, I think you can. I think you can learn some skills.
I mean, there's literary training, you know, comes in very handy. Some philosophical training comes in very handy. But it's not necessary. It's just necessary to articulate what you're noticing about the film in ways that connect with people. Yeah.
But just watching some film with people who are inside you in that way, and it's not just like you notice that, and suddenly my eyes are opening to it. So I think doing that with somebody
does open your eyes.
Excellent.
Yeah. No, it's an apprenticed sort of thing to learn. Yeah.
You get ideas from other people, and if you're watching, even if you're watching non-Christian, sometimes they bring out the ideas from you.
Oh, yeah, that happens a lot.
I think something I learned from the students I work with, people said, I'm not used to evaluating anything they see. So they're watching me and going, that's nice. And we start to talk about it.
But then.
No.
I always start off a movie discussion night with, okay, what'd you like? And people will respond on, well, I liked this, I didn't really like that, or what didn't you like? I really didn't like when blah, 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 blah. If you keep it at a very personal level, you don't say, I'm rendering my evaluation on this work of art or whatever, but just, what do you like, what don't you like, and what themes did you notice? And just walk them through that, and that leads all sorts of places.
Wait, when you invite your friend, are you saying to them, come over to watch a movie and I will discuss it, or just come over to watch a movie?
No, it's always movie discussion night.
Great, so they know.
So they know. And they come for the discussion.
Yeah.
And whenever they have to leave before we start discussing, there's profuse apologies. Yeah.
What is Yeah, I think Reynolds' point. I wonder if people make a mistake of assuming that because people are from a postmodern kind of mindset that they're not interested in truth per se. Whereas there's something that resonates with people that is looking for that authenticity of that truth. So there's something that people connect with. And that's one thing. And that when we assume that they're not actually interested in that, I wonder whether sometimes talk themselves out of the game and end up.
I wouldn't say that they're not interested in truth, but truth takes on different meanings for postmodernism. and it's a therapeutic culture. People are looking for what works and stuff like that. What I've noticed, the pattern I've noticed in my students, is they're first convinced that what the Bible says is good for the culture. These are good morals. These are good things. And then they're really impressed by the ideas that are found in Scripture. And then, like, third, they start becoming aware that Scripture really is true. And then it takes a long time for them to get to that, to say, I will claim this as my own. I think it's that true. So I'm not saying truth isn't an issue. It's not. It's not the leading edge I found among my students. And if I try to make it the leading edge, they start saying, okay, well, here comes Ted. I can have an intellectual debate with him. That's not what I want.
In that sense, I guess, what I see in street ministry is that if truth is ever abstracted from relationship, we're stuck. We've lost it.
Right. And that's why I don't want to make the choice. Yeah.
Maybe in one sense it's just as simple as that. It's just about loving people and interested in the context.
Yeah.
But the other thing I wondered though was that I think we do have a significant problem in when postmodern folks are reaching this kind of way and coming to Christ in whatever sense that means for them.
Uh huh.
I think we then have a very, very weak character. I wonder even if it is a biblical Christianity in any meaningful sense.
But see, once they become
once they become Christians, I would say part of their discipling is to ground them in the truth.
I think that's the core part of discipling. But the problem that we're finding is that for a whole generation of students in our world, that doesn't happen. So what you then have is you have an incredibly weak,
well,
wavering.
I would say that's
water.
Yeah. I would say that's a little bit of a different issue. That's a discipleship issue. When I taught a course on comparative religions last semester, and what I try to do is I try to show how each religion has an internal coherence, how it's a real thing that deserves respect. And then the last class, or the second to last class before the exam, I say, now if I've done my job well, you're going to say, well, they're all true. I want to show you why that can't be true. And I go through, I basically rip off Dick Kies for, on his stuff on his critique of relativism. Dick Kies, he's a Labrie guy. And what that does is, a lot of times it shuts down the postmodernists, but it gives them something to think about, something that's not easily wiggled out of. But one of the interesting things is, there was a girl who's an evangelical Christian in my class from America, and she wrote a response paper, and she said, I've always been hesitant to talk about Christianity as if it was uniquely true. You've given me reasons why I can, and that's really changed the way I think. So I would agree that that's not getting done. It can be done.
This is what we find with discipling students is one of their core things, is helping them to that confidence. Because the absence of that confidence, having cut, you know, some of the